Hello and welcome to Volume 73 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss the first thinning of a pine stand, how to avoid some common mistakes in your estate plan, and the recreational premium and how to get it. We'll also speak with a well-known expert in climate change who can help forest owners determine if they want to join in with the latest carbon sequestration craze. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. It's literally impossible to go to a meeting of forest leaders or pick up a forestry magazine without coming face-to-face with global warming. The forestry community has embraced the concept with both arms and is now encouraging carbon storage programs as a money-making enterprise. We've invited Dr. John Christie, a well-known expert on climate change, to help us explore how forest owners should make economic decisions while the scientists wrestle with their scientific decisions. Welcome, Dr. Christie.
Thank you.
Dr. Christie, I know that you have opinions about the role that humans play in climate change, but if some of the experts are right that humans play a large role in climate change, how do you suspect this might affect how forest owners make financial decisions in that type climate?
Well, the issue here is that if we have a role in climate change, we don't see that climate change in the southeast. So whatever has happened that humans might create or enforce just isn't happening in the southeast because we've not had increasing temperatures here. Globally, there is an increase in CO2, however, and that helps forests grow quite a bit. And so that will continue to happen, and forest owners can look forward to a more fertile atmosphere. The climate just is not changing here in the southeast, so they should look other than the year-to-year drought flood kind of situation. A forester would probably find out that if you look at the numbers, and you're correct that money is driving the whole system, if you're able to sequester 5 tons of CO2 an acre per year, and the cost is $15 for the cost of sequestering that, or you accrue that much, that's $75 an acre per year, which is much greater than harvesting forests. So if you are able to, you know, do that for a few years while the forest is growing, that's quite a bit of money that someone might save. So that alarm about climate change might lead to a benefit for foresters in terms of that money that can be made.
Well, what if the theories that humans are causing a large part of this climate change, what if that belief is false? What can happen then to these programs and systems that are set up in a place that many forest owners are buying into?
Well, the forest owners are pretty clever people, and they adapt quite well. And so I think they will follow wherever the money and the policy leads. I personally don't believe that there's going to be much of an effect of humans on climate, but it's the policy that they have to be aware of because that's where the money is made or lost. So I would, what can you do in that scenario is only adapt to what the policy has. And if you want to go out and lead the policy, you would want to have the hard data to back it up, and the kind that we do that shows it's not a real significant impact.
In a situation where there's competing ideas about this entire topic, do you see a time when there will be a generally accepted theory on climate change, or are we going to continue to have this debate about the role that humans play in the foreseeable future?
The debate will go on because it's such a complicated process that will never be solved. I think, though, as time goes on, we'll see how resilient the Earth is, and we have papers coming out this year showing that, and how little the humans really have on the climate system. I think for a forest owner, there are other opportunities besides carbon sequestration. If, you know, the things come out you've seen for Alabama, perhaps sugarcane can be grown for ethanol at a very high return rate, or even corn, that maybe other crops might be out there that would be useful for their property.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Christie. We appreciate you joining us.
Okay.
Our next guest actually has used his IRA as an individual retirement account to hold forest land. And this decision has probably well formed because he's a forester, a forest owner, and a banker. Don Heath joins us. Welcome, Don.
Glad to be here.
Do you see any potential problems with holding timberland in an IRA?
Yeah, there are really a couple. First, probably foremost, you can't really enjoy the intrinsic benefits of holding timberland that you could if you held it outside of an IRA.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, you give up the favorable tax treatment of owning timberland when you hold it in an IRA because of the sale of land or timber is treated as ordinary income. It's deferred. That tax is deferred, but eventually you'll have to pay at ordinary rates rather than capital gain rates.
Okay. Well, with those two cautions, are there some examples of some transactions that you're not able to do with your forest land if you own it that way?
Yeah, there are a number of prohibited transactions, and frankly, they are any transaction between a plan, the IRA, and a disqualified person. And when you look at that, a disqualified person is the IRA owner, any family member of the IRA, any corporation. You can't borrow money. There are a number of disqualified or prohibitive transactions associated with it, and you have to be very careful because the penalties for a prohibitive transaction cause the entire IRA to become taxable, and with penalties involved at that point. So they're pretty stiff.
Well, despite those cautions, you have actually decided to own forest land in an IRA. When would that ever be appropriate?
Well, it would be appropriate if you intend to invest purely for financial reasons and are willing to forego, at least for the time being, the intrinsic benefits of owning the timberland. Another situation might be if it's the only way you could buy a piece of land, if you're not necessarily happy with your returns of your current investments. That's the reason I did it. I at least invested in something that I know and felt like that I could predict my returns off of that timberland more so than I could stock or mutual funds.
So I guess you view yourself as a true investor, and when you're owning timberland in that way, and there's certain things that you can't do. You said you enjoy some of the intrinsic benefits, but not others, right?
That's correct.
Well, if you have only forest land and an IRA, is there any word of caution there as well?
Yeah, you need some liquidity. You're obviously going to have some expenses associated with that, and you need to have enough liquidity in your account to cover any expenses that you may incur. A good rule of thumb I like to look at is maybe 20% of your IRA needs to be liquid.
So you need to have some money to be able to do the projects that you are able to do, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, we'll try to put up a list of things that you can do and can't do if you own timber and an IRA. And, Don, we appreciate you joining us. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thank you.
Many years ago, you could tell someone was a field forester if you saw blue paint on his boots. Well, that's becoming a more rare sight now that pine thinnings are largely operator select rather than marked. But Tom Ebner is a forester consultant who has many years of experience with Weyerhaeuser, and he's in with the blue paint crowd. Hello, Tom.
Yes, sir.
Why do you recommend marking the first thinning in a southern pine plantation?
Well, I would first like to remind the listeners of why we thin. You know, we want to reduce the stand density by removing the poor quality trees and the slow growing trees in order to maintain rapid growth on the potential crop trees. And the poor quality trees are those with forks in that first 16 feet, and those with excessive sweep and crook. And the slow growing trees are probably caused by poor planting and microsite deficiencies and a lot in genetic quality. And these are the trees you want to remove in that first thinning, as they will be valued at pulpwood in subsequent thinnings. Now, in a marked thinning, the quality leaved trees are usually identified with paint, which may be done by the owner, a forestry consultant, or by a contract thinner. And in an operator select thinning, the thinner chooses which trees to take and which to leave.
Okay, so that's the chief difference between a marked stand and an operator select stand. Yeah, that's the difference between a marked stand and an operator select stand.
Yeah, in marked, you identify the leaved trees. In a select thinning, there is no marking, and the operator basically selects which ones to take.
Okay.
And then in marking the leaved trees, the first thinning is probably the highest financial return that the owner will make in their forest. Our analysis suggests a return of 28%. And the forest owner's best interest, we feel, are served by leaving the large quality trees in the first thinning And marking helps ensure that this happens. It doesn't guarantee it, but it does ensure it.
Is there a timing issue on when to thin your stand, whether you do marked or operator select? Is there a recommended time when you should start doing this?
Well, they do differ, but as far as the best time to thin, in our study, we got the best financial return with a thinning at age 13 and with very little loss at age 14 or 15. But most of our plots are located in an area that is tributary to a pulp mill, which likes young trees which have lower specific gravity. And in most of the southeast, this is not the case. And so you may find that the pulp mills in other areas may penalize thinnings under age 15 a little bit.
All right. How many trees per acre should be left after you're finished with your thinning?
Well, I think that a good average number would be about 200 trees per acre. And this is going to vary by the age you thin, by the site index, and by the stand diameter before thinning. Now, the objective of this would be to leave the number of trees that will grow to a basal area of around 130 at about the same time that it reaches an average diameter of 11 inches, so that those second thinning removals can be sold for a higher value to a large chip and saw mill.
If you looked at this thinning and you know, looked at the space between the trees, and I know it varies based on the size, the diameter of the tree itself, but are we talking about something roughly 15 feet apart or something along that, in that range?
I think that I haven't done the square. I have done it, but I don't remember. But I think it's probably around 15 or 16 feet.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Tom. We appreciate it very much. Thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you.
While doing a good job on your first thinning can add dollars to your pocket at the end of the rotation, adding recreational features to your property can add dollars now. Shelley Cheetah has experience in what she calls fee access programs. That's allowing someone to use your land for a fee. Hello, Shelley.
Good morning, Hayes.
There's an emerging trend among forest landowners, private forest landowners in particular, to initiate fee access programs in their lands. What is driving that trend?
Well, Hayes, part of the driving force comes from the public at large. There's a growing interest among them for experiencing quality recreation, and they're having a harder time finding that on public lands. Part of that's because actively managed forests are healthy for us, and with that comes all of those benefits like growing animal populations, which are not only prized by hunters but also by individuals who like to get out and just view our wildlife. Recent restrictions on OHV use and ATV use on public lands is also fueling a growing interest in the private property opportunities that might be available for trail or play area construction. Also, most of the land that's owned in the urban interface areas near our denser population zones is held by the private sector rather than the public sector. And with the rising cost of gas, folks are trying to find a way to get out to those forest recreation experiences but keep it closer to home.
Is there a one way to approach the issue of fee access, or is it something that needs to be customized to your land?
It really needs to be customized. It needs to fit the landowner's goals and objectives. And most of all, whatever's designed and developed must work along with the industrial routine management practices associated with a forest, whether it's being actively logged at the time, whether it's just routine management activities that must be ongoing. The recreation program has to be designed in a way to incorporate that primary property activity.
Okay. If you're interested in something like this, a program like fee access to your land, how do you get started?
Well, the very first step is that the owner must determine that they're going to make a commitment to invest company time and resources toward investigating whether or not this is an acceptable solution to them. And that solution needs to address many needs. Are there ongoing problems at the time, such as trespass issues, trash dumping issues, other illegal activities that might be occurring on the property that they're trying to remove, associated with do they want to create a revenue source? because there definitely are different management approaches to dealing with nuisances versus dealing with revenue creation.
Okay. All right, Shelley, thank you for that. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Harry Haney is a well-known expert in forest taxation. He and his wife are also owners of an Alabama tree farm. He's been highlighting the experience that some forest owners have when they don't have a will. Welcome, Dr. Haney.
Good morning, Hayes.
Just give us an outline of why it's important to have a will. Do you have to have one? And if you don't, what are the consequences?
Well, a will is a privilege. And if you don't make your own will and designate who would receive your estate, then the state of Alabama or the state where you reside will do so for you. And typically, you would have unexpected heirs and some unexpected consequences, and the executor cannot make any changes to benefit one heir that may have specific needs or special needs. An associated problem is an inadequate will, and when you've managed that property for a long time, sometimes we lose sight of the appreciation in value and also a certain amount of speculative values that have crept into the price of forest land, and we have some unexpected taxes to deal with. Now, these problems, that is, the lack of a will or an inadequate will, are often caused because we fail to recognize our own mortality, and we are afraid of losing control. So this is very wasteful after we've managed our forest efficiently when it comes to the transfer to the next generation.
Could you talk a little bit about those unexpected taxes, both in connection with increasing prices in timberland and what things can be done to avoid that if you do have a will?
Well, this year we have a $2 million, what's known as an exemption equivalent. And at the first transfer in a marriage of husband and wife, there should be no tax. It should be deferred. And the way you have to do that is to take advantage of that $2 million exemption equivalent in both estates. And this is done by a will that directs to the children or other heirs an amount equal to $2 million, and the balance is protected from taxes by the marital deduction. For example, if you just simply have an I love you will that directs everything to your spouse, there'll be no tax at that first death. But that comes at the loss of that $2 million exemption. So it's very important to make sure that that's in there. And if the survivor needs the income from all of the property, it can be simply put in a bypass, what's known as a credit bypass trust, so that the survivor has the income at least annually from those assets. Now, because of the increase in the values of forest property due to growth and inflation and appreciation, an estate may, and often does, go over $4 million. That is, a $2 million savings at that first because of the exemption, and another $2 million when the second spouse dies. In those cases, you should consider special use valuation. And with that, in 2008, you can reduce the market value of your property by $970,000 to what we call special use value, the use value of the trees of the forest for growing timber. And so doing, then you can, in addition to the credit, put specially valued property in that bypass trust, and it amounts to roughly $3 million. And then you can specially value the property when it goes to the survivor the next time. So now we're up to about $6 million. Another special forestry feature is deferral and extension. And under deferral and extension, if there are liquidity problems, you can defer the payment of the estate tax at very favorable interest rates for 5 years and then pay it off in installments. And this gives you time to get the business affairs in order and catch the market at a more opportune time than, say, at the present time.
Okay. All right. Dr. Haney, thank you for joining us. Well, it's not uncommon to use a sophisticated aircraft like a helicopter to perform basic management strategies on forest land. Michelle Eisenberg with Custom Air has been helping forest landowners for years with their herbicide programs. Welcome, Michelle.
Good morning, Hayes.
What is the process for a landowner to have herbicide work done on the property?
Okay, if the landowner is considering having some herbicide work done, the first thing they need to do, if they are working with a consultant or with Forestry Commission or a landowner assistance forester, they need to contact them so that they can use their network. If a landowner does not have a consultant that they're utilizing, they can directly work with Custom Air or any of the other providers of that service out there. I would recommend that they utilize their consultant or their forestry commission, because what those folks do is they'll put several tracks together in the area and then take that entire package to the contractor. And at that point, it's going to be a little bit easier for them to negotiate all the processes of it, because your consultant that you're paying them to handle it, or the forestry commission or landowner assistance forester will handle it for you at that point.
Mm-hmm. What's the best time for landowners to get started on this type program?
As soon as they think they're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I say that is a lot of folks wait till the last minute to say, I need a site prep or I need to do release. They generally wait till the middle of the season, July, August, September, and what you'll see happen is the majority of the contractors out here will be booked up for the season. We work several months ahead of time trying to lay out the logistics of our routes and how we go through areas. So if they know that they're going in and thinning an area this year, they need to be considering their herbicide treatments for next year and start to get the process going immediately.
You mentioned the usefulness of working with others to get your helicopter work done, your herbicide work done. Is there a smallest size acreage that really just can't be used in an air application or even in a ground application?
There's not. We can pretty much get to every acre out there that folks need to be sprayed. But just like I talked about logistics, when we start to look at our own programs, we go through certain counties and we know where the tracks are. We go through and pick them up. We've sprayed 2-acre kudzu patches. I met with a consultant yesterday. We're going to pick up a 7-acre kudzu patch because I'm only going to be 15 miles up the road treating another track. So it's really important to find somebody else in the area that's going to be spraying. Or, you know, if the landowner contracts directly with us, what I usually do is I look to see where else we're going to be. So there's not a smallest acreage we'll get to because there's so much of the area here that's going to be covered. So I would say there's definitely not a bottom line.
All right. Thank you, Michelle. We appreciate
Thank
you joining
you.
Us.
Thank you, Hayes.
Ralph Helmick is a busy man these days. He's with the State Oil and Gas Board, and although his focus right now is in offshore drilling in Mobile, we wanted to check in with him and get his thoughts about oil and gas exploration in the South, and particularly in Alabama. Hello, Ralph.
Good morning, Hayes. How are you doing today?
With oil prices as high as they are, I would imagine that oil exploration is expanding. Can you give us a kind of an overview of what's going on in the state?
Certainly. We have been quite busy in the state of Alabama, just like I think in the rest of the nation. We've had a lot of activity in Alabama. The Oil and Gas Board, we're the regulatory oversight authority for the industry as to drilling. We've had a significant discovery a few years ago in Conecuh County, the Little Cedar Creek Field. And it's now the largest producing field in Alabama with up near over 6,000 barrels of oil per day. We have a lot of activity with the tight Devonian shales in North Alabama along the Appalachian Fold and Fault region up through St. Clair all the way down through Greene County, and that's kind of a developing trend. And then we also have we have new discoveries in Escambia County, Covington County, and over in Washington County. And all of that is because of the price increase. We're drilling wells quite rapidly, and Alabama is producing, it's stabilized our production to a point here in Alabama and has kept us quite busy.
The Oil and Gas Board that you work for, does it provide any services that landowners can take advantage of?
Certainly. One thing you can do through our website, you can track online production statistics of your well, or if you're interested in wells that your relatives have or friends or whoever, and you're able to go on site. All production statistics, our board hearings, all facts relating to the various counties, And through our sister agency, the Geological Survey, you're also able to do a lot of scientific reviews of the counties. But we also are basically the middleman for the industry. We protect all rights equally and oversee the drilling activities. And here in the Mobile office, we keep the activity report for South Alabama that has up-to-date information as to exactly where the drilling rigs are depth-wise and things. But a lot of good information is through our website and can be gathered there or just by calling up and talking to our personnel. We have geologists, engineers. We have a lawyer on site that works with us also.
I would imagine what you're saying sounds pretty exciting, and if you're a landowner who might have land in this particular area where you're talking about these new fields, pretty excited as well. Do you have any words of caution, cautionary advice whenever you're approached by a landman or leasing oil and gas properties?
Certainly. Of course, the state does not enter into the leasing aspect of it. That's basically a private contract between the landowner and whatever company they're into. And we just tell people to basically remember that a lease is a negotiable instrument. And if there are particular things, especially timber owners that want to protect timber, they can always try to negotiate into that instrument protections for their property and specific clauses in those leases. And we usually recommend that, you know, you become familiar with that and do a lot of research. There are some, there's actually a publication that one of our personnel put together called A Landowner's Guide to Oil and Gas in Alabama. Mm-hmm. And it can be bought for just a few dollars. And it has a lot of the terms of the industry because they're very specific in the terminology and everything. So I just remind people to be very careful when you lease your property. It is a contract that carries great implications.
Okay. Thank you, Ralph. Appreciate it. In our markets chair today is Mike Ward. Mike is with Southern Timberlands, and he regularly helps forest landowners market their property. He's noticed what many people are calling the recreational premium that some forest owners have, so we thought we'd get him to explain. Hello, Mike.
How you doing, Hayes?
What would the profile be of someone who was interested in investing in a piece of recreational property?
Well, it's somebody that is tired of, like, the stock market going up and down every day. They sometimes can lose $50,000 or $100,000 a day, and they want to put their money in something that is more stable. And also people like that are buying condos, that have bought condos in the past at the Gulf. We've seen a lot of people now. Matter of fact, I had a friend yesterday that called me that he wants to sell his condo, and he's lost a lot of money in it and wants to put it in a recreational piece of property that he can see his money grow. Of course, you know, we've had several guests on the show today talking about timber, and if you buy the right piece of property with some timber there, you can get a good, steady income stream off of it.
Okay. What do people look for when they're looking at, I know what you look for just in forest land, but I'm talking about forest land with that recreational premium. What are you looking for?
Well, you're looking for something that's got some timber value on it, something that you can get a steady income off of through the years. But also, you know, different people look for different things. Some people want a piece of property that's close to their home so that they don't have to drive 2 or 3 hours to get to it. Some people want to be in the Black Belt, and they don't care if they have to drive 2 or 3 hours to get to it because the Black Belt has better quality deer.
Mm-hmm.
So it just varies on what people are looking for out of a piece of property and how far they want to drive.
If you already have some land and you'd like to enhance its value for recreation purposes, what things do you see really pay off?
Oh, man, there's a lot of things you can do to a piece of property to really increase the value of it. One thing that has really gotten big in Alabama and really throughout the country is putting game fences up. There are people putting game fences up, and it depends on the size of the property. You can put a game fence up that costs about $25,000 a mile. And let's say you have about 500 acres. That's going to cost you $100,000 to $125,000. But when you put the deer in, a lot of times you buy northern deer now, and when you put deer in there and they grow real big, you can turn that $125,000 into something that might be worth $500,000 or more. So that's a big thing that people are doing now.
What are some things in the lower budget range?
Well, you got lakes. You can put lakes on your property. That increases the value of your property. You can put, you know, a nice house on there so that you can entertain clients and family. And you just fix your property up to where you have year-round entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you can enjoy your recreational property.
All right. Well, those are some thoughts for us, Mike. Thank you very much.
Thank
and that's
you.
All the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to John Christie, Don Heath, Tom Ebner, and Shelley Cheetah. We also appreciate the contributions of Harry Haney, Michelle Eisenberg, Ralph Helmick, and Mike Ward. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.